Hi, this is Against Everyone with Connor Abib. Friends, you could probably guess that I'm someone who's interested in violence. I'm someone who writes about it, and I have lots of other writers and filmmakers and thinkers who are concerned with violence on the show. And I wonder why our imaginations bend towards it so much. More specifically, why do our imaginations bend with the contours of murder? Murder is something that is at once melodramatic, preposterous, horrifying, cruel, and it's something I and so many of us are interested in, deeply interested in. Why? This is something that I explore on this episode of the show with Mark O'Connell, who, in the writing of his new book, A Thread of Violence, A Story of Truth, Invention, and Murder, found Mark face-to-face, literally, with someone who has murdered two people in an almost absurd, chaotically cast web of rage, desperation, lies, violence, and deception. If you live outside Ireland, you probably don't know the story of these two murders in 1982. So here's the bare bones of it. Malcolm MacArthur was, at the time, a sort of man of leisure and an aesthete who, upon finding his finances and the finances of his family dwindling, created this strange and erratic plan to commit armed robbery for more money. But his plan didn't just go haywire like some heist movie. He decided, as this non-plan didn't even come close to unfolding, to kill two people as if possessed, murdering Bridie Gargan with a hammer after stealing her car, and shooting Donald Dunn with his own shotgun. After killing them, the series of events didn't get any more mundane. Instead, it continued to be what was called here grotesque, unbelievable, bizarre, and unprecedented. That actually gave rise to an acronym, GUBU, in Ireland, that a lot of Irish people just know, even if they don't know that it's connected to these murders. MacArthur hid out almost in plain sight as a guest at the house of the unknowing Attorney General of Ireland before he was caught. Mark was interested in this story his whole life and did scholarly work in school on John Banville, whose novel, The Book of Evidence, is based on these crimes, or the characters are inspired by the people in this story. But after he did that scholarly work, Mark found himself thinking still about these murders in the non-fictional sense. What happened, why somebody would do such a thing, and why we are interested in it. It led to Mark spending time, lots of time, in fact, over a few years, with Malcolm MacArthur, who had been released from prison in Ireland, and trying to get to the heart, if there is one, of what exactly this means, not just for the murderer, and not even just for the victims, but for all of us, what's at stake here, what's happening. The most common approach to murderers is that they're monsters. And that's certainly something that people say of Malcolm MacArthur. But is this idea just an attempt to divest ourselves and distance ourselves from the possibility that we ourselves are capable of great violence? I mean, we are all connected to murder in a way. Whether we're in the military or related to someone who's in the military, whether we ignore policies of desk killers, the people who sign policies that result in the cruel loss of life, devastation sometimes planned by people who sign these policies in multinational companies and governments, or maybe it's just the connection that we have to the destruction and death that is related to our everyday consumer choices. We think of murderers as monsters, but it may be that we do so not to say that they're distant from us, because if we look at that, it doesn't really make sense. Maybe it's about the way we view the world itself and where these people fit in and what they do to us, what their acts do as they echo out into what we think the world is.
When something is horrendous and as like aberrant as these kind of random murders happens, it's the destruction of a story that we have about our lives, which is that we're basically safe and people are basically good. And
it shows us how feeble all our ideas about how the world work are. Nationalisms and theories about society, about psychiatry, about all that, it makes it all fall away. So it's actually a strike at the way that we organize our view of the world, no matter what that view might be. And so I think that that's why the monster line is the most used, is because the only thing that would ever do that really, you know, is a monster.
I'm so excited to share this episode with you. And I also want to say that at the end of this episode, Mark reads from the book a powerful passage about how MacArthur's presence in Mark's life begins to blend with the everyday.
Hi, everybody. It's Against Everyone with Connor Abib. Hello again, Mark O'Connell.
Hey, Connor. Good to be back.
Okay, so let me see how this fits if I bring your new book, A Threat of Violence, into the context of your other books. Because it seems to me like throughout your writing career, your big works are about figuring out what people's sort of strange desires to disappear their own humanity are actually about. So, you know, we start with a book about transhumanism, which you and I have talked about. People are interested in the disappearance of humanity as this sort of desirable thing. Let me bring in these algorithmic computer components to my life, robotic components. And then we have people that are fantasizing in some ways about the end of the world. How do I prepare myself for it? In your next book. Well, in this one, it seems also like you're thinking about how someone might disappear their own humanity, the disappearance of their humanness, by murdering two people. But whereas with the other two, it seemed like you came up with solutions or some sort of way to resolve how it happened. Oh, well, these desires to merge with machines are actually these kinds of desires that have been distorted. The sort of transhumanism is a compromised solution for certain kinds of desires. This desire for the end of the world is actually this other kind of desire for a sort of idea of being a capitalist ubermensch or something like that. And in this case, though, with Malcolm MacArthur, the subject of your latest book, it seems like you haven't necessarily been able to resolve it in that way. That, in fact, the disappearance of humanness in this case, which is somehow smaller and seeming some way than the others, where it's one person, it's not a movement, is actually not resolvable for you, that you can't be understood in the way the others can be understood.
Yeah, I think that's, it's really true. And there's two things, I suppose, about that question. I absolutely agree that the book is full of unresolved questions. It's like, you know, the last word of the book is darkness, and, you know, it goes from darkness with some flickering illuminations, sometimes illusory, sometimes real, back into darkness at the end. And it is, it's a book that's just full of doubt and questioning and, you know, uncertainty in various forms. I mean, it's interesting to hear you put it in that way about the sort of disappearance of humanness You know, I never really thought of it in that way, and I've never really heard anyone describe it in quite that way. And it's interesting to hear the project, such as it is, linked to, you know, previous books, because I've always seen it as like a hard left turn. Of course, there's no such thing. I mean, you're interested in what you're interested in, and your obsessions are what they are to some extent. You know, the way that I think about MacArthur and my ongoing sort of encounters with him, I think the problem for me that I'm trying to solve is that, like, there is no disappearance of humanness. All of this is within the kind of realm of the human. You know, I hope never to lose sight of both the sheer awfulness of what he did and the pain that he's caused to you know, many people along the way, but also to never lose sight of his humanity. And I don't mean that in a kind of a spirit of generosity. You know, I mean that in a spirit of almost hope, some kind of objectivity. That yes, this is human. This is one of the things that people do. They kill other people. And I don't, you know, I also don't think, so one of the ways that I thought about this person when I was writing the book and my interest in him and my ability to spend time with him and write about him is that, you know, I've read a bunch of true crime books at this point. It's a genre that I have some interest in. And some of the best true crime books are about, you know, I think truly monstrous people, like Gordon Burns' book about Peter Sutcliffe. I don't know if you've ever read it, but it's like an extraordinary book. But it's just unrelentingly dark. And he wrote another book about Fred West. And like, these people are, to the extent that we can call people monsters, they are monstrous humans. You know, they're aberrations. And I don't think MacArthur fits into that slot. You know, there is something about him that is very different, and he's not a good man, but he's not a monster. And you know, I wanted to never lose sight of his complicated, contradictory, difficult humanity, you know?
Yeah, well, let me rephrase the original statement in a way, but then also I want to touch on whether or not he's different than, I mean, you make a point of saying this isn't like Jeffrey Dahmer or some, but I want to go into that with you and see.
Maybe we would want to say that Jeffrey Dahmer is as human as the rest of us. Maybe that's the more disturbing way to think about it. I don't know if I want to go there.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it, right? I mean, I just want to pull out maybe some parts of the book and sort of think through that with you. I don't have a conclusion exactly. But instead of saying losing humanness then, because I understand why you might object to that, I think what I'm getting at is there's a certain, this is a way of being human. That seems less understandable to you than these other ways of being human, all of which are in some ways fascinated with the loss of a sense of humanity. I'm losing my sense of humanity becoming a machine. I'm losing my sense of humanity being separated out from the millions and millions of people who will die. I've lost my sense of humanity in these moments when I killed these other people. These are all ways of not, these are all ways of being human. Yeah. But there's this one that seems less understandable to you. And now, in some ways, you could say that people like Peter Thiel or some of the other transhumanists or sort of rich doomsday preppers haven't committed any crime. But of course, they have committed horrible atrocities in some way as well. So this kind of being human with this kind of atrocity seems less, seems somehow to not be a theoretical, it can't be smoothed out with a theory.
He's like, the book in a way is a process of trying to understand MacArthur, trying to put him into sort of conceptual pigeonholes, and failing in various different ways, you know. I would say part of the reason for that, you know, a lot of it has to do with this man himself and his sort of slipperiness and his, you know, inconsistent connection with the reality of what he did. Part of it is definitely that. But part of it is also, when I wrote those first two books, I didn't spend a huge amount of time with the people that I was writing about. I was engaging mostly with ideas through people. So with those books, the ideas came first, and the people were sort of illustrations of those ideas in a way. And this is something I've only really come to understand or to feel since I wrote A Thread of Violence, which is that in some way, the more time you spend with someone as a writer, and I don't know whether this is necessarily true of human relationships across the board, I suspect it isn't, but as a writer, your job is to try to understand someone that you spend time with, or to try to make some sense of them. And I feel that if I had spent 2 hours with MacArthur, if I had interviewed him for a short newspaper article or something like that, I probably could have walked away from that encounter with a sense of who he was, a fairly solid sense of here's my read on this guy at least. Whereas, I spent dozens and dozens of hours with him over the course of, it's now, it's over 2 years. And it's like, well, here's the way I've started to think of it. I don't know if you saw that Giacometti exhibition that was in the National Gallery last year. I went to see that right around the time I had just finished the book. And one of the extraordinary things about Giacometti is that he had a very small number of subjects that he worked on throughout his life. So he, particularly his brother, he made representations of his brother, paintings and, of course, sculptures throughout the course of his life, from his teens until I think when his brother died. And he kept doing these representations over and over again. And he said this amazing thing about it, which is that the more time you spend looking at a person's face, the more mysterious they come to seem. And that really hit me. It's true, I think, of just being face to face with someone. Like if I were to sit here and just stare at your face, and try to really understand your face, it would come to seem really strange and almost alien in a way. It's that thing of estrangement, that Russian formalist idea. And I think there's something like that going on with me and MacArthur, that I spent so much time with him that he started to seem more and more mysterious, and even to the point, and I get at this a little bit towards the end of the book, but there were times when he just looked completely different to me. There were times when I would look at him and I would think, oh, he looks like that character from the Fast Show, that old posh rambling drunk guy, or he looks exactly like Prince Philip, or and he would just seem different to me at different times. And some of that has leaked into the book, and I've kind of lent into it in a way, that feeling of essential unknowability and mystery. I don't know if that...
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting because when you're in love, I think a lot of people have this moment where they look at their partner mm-hmm. and they're like, oh, are they ugly? Like you'll have this flash of a thought. Or you might think, oh, when they get old, they're going to be ugly or whatever, or suddenly their face kind of rearranges as a resonance for you. Now, if you're lucky, it goes away. It's not something that lands on you or stays with you. But sometimes you can sort of see an angle of someone and the kind of glamour of the feeling that has been offered to you disappears for a minute. And I've always found those moments very strange, or sometimes... I mean, I suppose anyone who's ever had body dysmorphia can sort of relate to what you've said as well, where you look in the mirror and you think, how can other people see that when I see this? That there's some sort of contradiction there. And again, it just doesn't quite make sense. And then when you notice it, you can't solve it necessarily. You just have to kind of hold it and just be like, well, there are two faces to my lover, or maybe more. There are different versions of me. And I think that's really hard, So something I kept thinking about in this was, I wrote this essay about my ex-boyfriend who beat me up. And one of the lines in there was, he was at the end of the essay was he took me to this place where he had seen this fossil basically as a kid. And he was like standing on a hill, like looking for where the fossil was still embedded in the ground and looking for it. And after he beat me up, I kept thinking about that moment. I was like, he was such a boy, standing there looking, not the person who sent me to the hospital,
and I could not bring the two versions of him together. It was so unbearable to hold both of them at the same time, and yet there it was. And it sounds like there's, I don't know if unbearability is actually the feeling that you would reach for, but when we find those splits, it's really, really difficult.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's so interesting. And it, like, yeah, there is something at the center of this book which is irreconcilable. And, you know, part of the conflict or contradiction that I'm trying to negotiate in the book is, you know, I spend a lot of time with this guy and, you know, there's this person sitting in front of me who is extremely polite, very erudite, in a lot of ways quite thoughtful, you know, and in certain sort of not entirely frivolous ways, a nice man, you know? Although there are many moments in which I found him extremely difficult and unpleasant to be around, maybe more. But, you know, it was very difficult to square this person who's sitting in front of me, you know, talking about string theory or, you know, often geology, things like that, with the idea that this man did these things, you know, these kind of delicate manicured hands held a hammer that beat Bridie Gargan to death and destroyed so many lives and, you know, shot a man in the face. To square those two things was difficult and sometimes felt impossible, but I wanted to do it, and I didn't just want to do it for myself. I wanted him to recognize that he was the person who did these things, you know, and that was often very difficult. And that's why the book is kind of about a relationship. It's not just about a man or a story. It's about a relationship in some ways founded on this, like, maybe futile insistence on my part that he recognize who he is, you know? And I think for MacArthur, that is a conflict as well within him. You know, he knows he can't deny that he did what he did. He admitted to it. He was convicted of it. But yet at some level, he feels that it wasn't quite him, you know, that it doesn't define who he is.
Yeah. And I think that the sort of common conceptions about murder and why it happens, they don't actually help. They probably drive that deeper. So what I have in mind here is, okay, there's the typical one of he's just a monster, which is it can't be true. Mm-hmm. And that
it's comforting. It's too comforting to be true.
Yeah, that one obviously seems there to divest us of any.
But it's so
proximity.
Strange because when I say he's not a monster, people kind of go, and you know, I've done interviews where I've said this or I've been asked, you know, and people are like, really, he's not a monster? Well, what can you possibly mean by that, you know?
Well, right, and you know, what is their, where's their definition coming? But then there's the whole other part of it, the other way that people now handle murder, which is they kind of put it into some sort of like some sort of social cause thing, like like two examples I'm thinking of are, you know, when Slavoj Žižek's talking about going to see the Joker, and he's like, I'm not going to go see it. He's like, I'm going to already give you a review, which is like, oh, this poor guy, he was like really treated horribly by society and his family, and therefore he became this maniac killer. He's like, but most people who are in those situations don't. So why is this the backstory?
Yeah.
So that, in other words, there's some causal thing, and you went a ways to explore that with the childhood angle, but then there's also a class angle and all that. But then the other thing I'm thinking of is another murderer in Ireland, was this guy who recently, last year in Sligo, was meeting men on Grindr, having them come over and then mutilating to the fact that they were almost beheaded.
Yeah.
And that's being tried in Ireland now as someone who is committing hate crimes. Mm-hmm. And to me, I'm like, that's a serial killer. That's not, why are we calling this homophobia? I'm not saying that can't work its way in or whatever, but it's beyond the social critique of a certain kind of behavior.
Right. This is not like fascism in action. This is something else.
Right.
Yeah. We have that problem. It's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, but this is you know, different and right. more in a way.
And so yeah. that's what I think. It's like, even our most complex and sometimes correct theories can't smooth out or explain, and they get yeah. applied. It's either monster, you're completely removed from society, you're unlike anyone else, or yeah. you're just suffering from the same conditions yeah. that everybody else suffers yeah. from.
Yeah, it's funny, like, you know, in a way, I think that the most radical thing I did with the book is something that no one has noticed, because it's something I don't do, which is I never use the language of psychiatry to try to account for what he did. And it was never even really a temptation. It just felt like absolutely right that I should not even speak to a forensic psychiatrist. Well, you know, I did after I'd finished the book, and it was very interesting to speak to these people. And I read on your recommendation, actually, Gwen Adsad's book, which I was, you know, is sort of remarkable for how it doesn't really use the language of her profession overly, you know? She encounters these people as not a collection of symptoms, but as like suffering humans who cause suffering to other humans. And I thought it was really important in my book to not use that language, to not say, well, you know, we can see here an example of pathological narcissism, or, you know, whatever might, you know, whatever page of the DSMV might, you know, account for what he did. And I just felt that language, and it's a similar thing with the language of, you know, class analysis, or, you know, history, or whatever else you might try to frame, you might try to put in it. They seem to explain a lot. You feel like you've done a lot of explaining, but actually you've just put a sort of a pasteboard figure right. in front of the reality, which is way more murky and way more unknowable. And, you know, I guess in a way MacArthur's crimes and he as a person are kind of overdetermined in some sense, you know. There was a version of the book really early on, and my extremely tolerant American editor, Yaniv Soha, heard me say this, and he was like, yeah, sure, I mean, go for it if it helps. I assume that he was already planning to you know, edit it out in future drafts. But there was a very early version of the book that I considered writing, which was like, I don't know if you've ever read the book Exercises in Style by Raymond Queneau. Mm-hmm. You know that book?
Yeah.
So there was like a version of the book in my mind which had like, you know, X number of explanations for what MacArthur did. Uh-huh, like to uh-huh. use, you know, he was a pathological narcissist, yeah, or, yeah, yeah. you know, he did it because of class, or he did it because of his mother, or he did it because of male toxic rage or whatever. And all of these things would amount to like a just really radically overdetermined explanation of MacArthur, and would kind of fall apart in the reader's hands because there's too many explanations and there's none, you know? So I wanted to do a kind of an exercise in style on MacArthur. I think I'm glad I didn't do that, but yeah. some version of that is present in the book, you know?
Yeah. That's the Zadie Smith has a thing about that every writer, you know, ends up creating a scaffolding for their book, and then they have to
abandon
the task
it.
Is to yeah get rid of it completely. Yeah. You know, yeah. you can't let it
and
be
I think
visible.
To his great credit, my editor instinctively understood that. I was just like, if you need to do that, you need to do that, and at some point, I will need to stop yeah. you. But yeah,
yeah. I mean, I think it's so interesting that you say that, because it's like, in some ways, that's exercises in reality. Because there was so many attempts, it seemed like, for you and others to say, this is why he did this. And even for him, he couldn't quite, in all the ways he speaks about, he can't quite bring it into any sort of reason. He tries at the end of the book, he comes up with this sort of strange theory that makes more sense in a way than any of the others.
But it's too good, you know? It's too good.
Yeah.
Too good to be true.
But at least...
And I'm tempted by it, for sure.
Yeah.
And I still think it's like, wow, I can't believe he, you know, explained it through narrative, which is sort of the theme of the book in a way, but...
Yeah.
It's too... It's
he might have just been spending too much time with you.
Possibly.
You know?
Possibly,
where he tries to narrativize his own behavior and, you know, in terms of aesthetics and character in a way. But I find it so interesting. It's like... it's almost like reality itself can't handle when people are murdered. Like, that's what I kept feeling when I read this. It was like somehow this kind of
super dense black hole that started swallowing everything that came near it. And it started transforming people. There was like someone thought he was John Banville at a certain point, which I think is so funny. John Banville, for people who don't know, wrote the novel Book of Evidence, based on Malcolm MacArthur. In some ways it's changed dramatically, but it's a great novel. And Mark was, I suppose, a Banville scholar.
I did my PhD
on Banville, you know, and then someone thought he was this politician who had sort of screwed up Ireland, Ireland's economic life. A detective portrayed him, a detective who was investigating him, portrayed him in, reenactment on TV of the crimes.
Right.
And it's like, it's this weird thing where reality is kind of like reshaping and playing around with the theories of what happened itself. And I kept thinking of that. I have so much more to say about that, but before I do, I should stand back and maybe let you say anything that's coming up for you when I say that.
Yeah, that's so interesting. It's not that I never thought about this, but this whole thing of like mistaken identity is sort of a weird little sub theme in the book, you know, the Sean Fitzpatrick thing, the John Banville thing, you know, even something that's not in the book is, I don't know if you've read Fintan O'Toole's book, We Don't Know Ourselves, the book about
Ireland. I haven't read it, but I know.
But there's an extraordinary bit in that book where he doesn't go into it in at a huge length, but there is a chapter about the MacArthur affair, which, you know, Fintan was a young journalist in Dublin at the time, but he writes about it in this extraordinary way, because like when they were looking for him after the murders, before he was arrested, there were descriptions of him in the media as like this, man in his 30s with sort of curly hair and, you know, wore a bow tie and so on. And O'Toole writes about it as like, this is the description of me. I'm going to get caught. And, I spoke to his wife the other day and she was like, yeah, we were really, you know, we were worried that he was going to, because, you know, they lived in the area where they were looking for MacArthur, and, you know, people were kind of looking at Fintan O'Toole in this like strange way. Is this the guy, you know? So there's just so much of that in the book that people almost see themselves in this weird, uncomfortable way in MacArthur, I think.
Yeah, it drags everyone in. I mean, I was thinking about that so often. It's like reality is like working to disguise his presence or somehow get people to relate to him with a different face, which is something that is essentially what you're trying to do in the book, which I find strange. But then there's also this thing where it's like, what all the aspects of a murderer and MacArthur in this case, they all get also kind of externalized as people's behaviors around what happened. So I'm thinking about the rage of the crowd when he's being tried and the woman that hits him, that hit her handbag or something like that, right?
Yeah.
In the neck. So there's rage, or there's like, there's also this idea of disconnection, okay? Where the politician, I don't know how much I'll get into him, but the political figure that he stayed with is trying to be like, I'm not part of this. This isn't part of me. Like he tries to sort of leave. And so there's also a disconnect in the murders. And then there's this self-fascination, which is you in the case of this book. And MacArthur also has this like self-fascination even during, it's like everything he was became a part of the ways that people responded to what he did. Like somehow it exploded and became the responses. It's so strange. And I just kept thinking about all these ways in which our world gets sort of shaped and messed up and mixed up with these kinds of acts. And it's, you know, I know that maybe I'm just a more spiritually minded person, so people aren't going to be thinking about it in that way themselves. But these are the things that I sort of attended to. I just thought, how like a giant MacArthur personality are all these responses sort of collected in, you know, what's happening publicly?
Yeah, there is a really strong I guess, and it's, I mean, you're making me think about the book in ways that I've not myself thought about it before, really consciously. But there is a strong theme of like recognition and misrecognition going on throughout the book. You know, I mean, one of the ways that I try to account for my interest in MacArthur is that he is both completely strange and other, but also I chose him as a subject because I feel that his strangeness and otherness is something that can be kind of mediated through a strange proximity, you know, that there's ways in which we're not entirely unlike. Right. And that's uncomfortable, but it is my route into MacArthur in a way. So yeah, and that's kind of like what I was saying about the sort of slightly comic Fintan O'Toole thing and like him being mistaken for John Banville and all these kinds of things. You know, there is this kind of weird sense of recognition and misrecognition going on throughout the book. And it's also true of Ireland, I think, you know. Ireland wants, you know, I think like when I started writing this book, when I started thinking about writing it, I talked to myself and other people about it in this way of like, you know what, this is like this really extraordinary thing that happened and this like really dark and somehow absurd story, but also like that's the top layer, and then underneath that maybe there's something that can be said about Ireland. Maybe there's some way in which we can try to explain Irish history and, you know, colonialism and post-colonialism and Ireland's strange relationship with class and so on through this story. And I, you know, it's a complete delusion in a way, but it brought me in. And as I started to actually meet MacArthur and talk to him and start to think seriously about this, that way of framing the story or thinking about it just completely fell away. It seemed to me that I just got less and less interested in the politics, less and less interested in the Irishness or otherwise, yeah, of the story. And it became like, I think, more or less purely an attempt to grapple with the singularity of this man and also with the sort of strangeness of the writer subject relationship.
Because in fact, that's what MacArthur does. He's obsessed with the Irishness of, you know, himself, others, how Irish.
Well, he almost doesn't recognize his own Irishness.
Yeah.
Which is itself another form of
misrecognition. Yeah. And then this like weird thing where he misremembers a line from Book of Evidence by John Banville as his, yeah, as an article that was about him. He killed one of theirs and that's why they were angry. And he was like, but I'm not a classist. I'm not whatever. And he's mulling over this, not realizing that that line is in a novel.
Yeah.
Again, so it's like,
he's responding to a fictionalized version of himself, you know, which is how, yeah, I encountered him first as well. You know, I encountered Freddie Montgomery, Banville's character, before I did MacArthur. And when I first see him, it's like, oh, it's Freddie Montgomery. Oh, no, it's the guy. It's, yeah, Malcolm MacArthur, you know.
Well, also interesting because I read Book of Evidence years ago. Mm. I mean, probably 20 years ago. And I didn't know this story. So I actually didn't even know it was based on anything.
Yeah.
So there's no resonance of that for me. It's just a great novel, you know, and then I find out and I'm like, oh, that's strange, yeah, you know.
And I think outside of Ireland, that's, you know, in itself, that's primarily what it is.
Yeah.
It just is a great novel. And like the basic sort of shape of it is the MacArthur affair, but
yeah,
he's filled this, you know, mold with something that is purely John Banville, you know.
Well, I just want to say, like, I think that that's part of why, I mean, obviously murder obsesses us for all sorts of reasons. And of course, you know, the primary reason we would hope would be because, you know, it's completely destroyed, you know, the lives of people around the victims and destroyed the victims themselves. There are these other aspects of it that I think are so disturbing. And I think this is one that you're touching on, which is that it actually shows us how feeble all our ideas about how the world work are. Nationalisms and theories about society, about psychiatry, about all that, it makes it all fall away. So it's actually a strike at the way that we organize our view of the world, no matter what that view might be. And so I think that that's why the monster line is the most used is because the only thing that would ever do that really, you know, is a monster, but it's like the being that makes all the lawfulness of the world go away. But right. in fact, it's not making it go away. It's revealing that there probably is some kind of order, but that that's not been accessible to us. And so we need to start again. We need to have new people theorizing, thinking through things because it's just not cutting it. You know?
Like we need a new story to I mean that's a really interesting analysis of it, for want of a better term, because like, you know, it strikes me listening to you talk that what you're saying is that when something is horrendous and as like aberrant as these kind of random murders happens, it's the destruction of a story that we have about our lives, which is that we're basically safe and people are basically good, and that gets completely ripped away, and so some new narrative has to be constructed around, you know, the murders have to then make sense in a different way or something. I don't know, but yeah, like it is like one of the things that I struggle with in the book on the page, I think, is that, you know, at a sort of a narrative level, at a level of like stuff happening, this is kind of like an amazing story, you know. And when I was telling people about this thing, you know, people outside of Ireland mainly, you know, my agent and my editor and so on, I would get this sort of sense of like, wow, I'm telling this story. And as I told it, I was making it my own, you know, as the more that I told it, the more that I was sort of taking possession of it. And that was like a really strange and kind of slightly disturbing thing that I, you know, was narrating myself into ownership of the story. And some, again, like some version of that is being struggled with in the book as well, because I don't own this story. And actually, it's not a story, you know? It lends itself to being told in that way. But so that's what I struggle with in the book, is like, you know, the sense that, oh, it's like a Coen Brothers movie. It's like this great yarn. But actually, no, it's this horrendous thing that made no fucking sense and still makes no fucking sense and still is a cause of like incredible pain to like quite a lot of people. And, you know, people who have never spoken about it or still find it difficult to speak about it. And, you know, there's a level at which none of this is reducible to story. Story is kind of, I guess, I hope it doesn't sound corny, but the book is in a way a book about stories. It's a book about narrative and the limits of those things.
Yeah,
because the truest version of something like this is to say there is no story. And actually, there's no truth, I think.
Yeah, well, maybe...
It's not to say that there's no truth. That's not true.
yeah.
The truth is, like, not reducible to narrative.
Well, that's it. That was maybe what I was going to sort of pull on there. Because, as you said, most people that would approach this story would either spend no time with him or spend an hour and sum it up, right? They'd reach for narrative forms that already existed, tropes that already existed, the kinds that made your friends say, I thought rather absurdly, but understandably, aren't you afraid he's going to kill you when you're over there? You know, like, because those are the stories that we know. That's how we know. Yeah. But when you spend more time with him, something more starts to happen. And I think it's not that you discover that everything is random and there's no sense to anything, but and everything's meaningless.
No,
which I think some people might also say after reading this book, oh, you're trying to make sense, but there is no sense to it. But instead, like, maybe looking for, when we try to understand the world, looking for causes and effects is actually not what the truth is made of. The truth isn't made of something that caused another thing, but rather pictures that are so vast that we can't see all of them, and we have to walk into them to even be able to understand at all. And then we feel our way around, we begin to get more of the contours of it, but we can't reduce it to this does this.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's why we have God. That's why we have the law. That's why we have science. They're all ways of explaining things that are, you know, extremely resistant to explanation because they're extremely complicated, you know? You could explain MacArthur, that the law has an explanation for him. Mm. Science, i.e. psychiatry, has a set of explanations. They're not very satisfactory, but they're there. Religion would have an explanation for him, you know. Yeah, and I'm kind of, I don't have access in a way to any of those languages, you know. And in a way, maybe that's what's, you know, I can imagine a certain kind of reader, maybe even myself, being fundamentally dissatisfied with the book and its kind of dwelling in darkness and uncertainty. Mm-hmm. But I do think there are situations in which, and this is one of them, that's the only truth we have.
Yeah, it's a truth that's bigger than the ways we're used to trying to understand the truth, I think. And so, you know, you have this part in there. So that's so good. I'm so glad you included this about, you know, when you're writing true crime, as this book could be seen as a true crime book or not, I think, there's this tendency now to be like, well, you need to focus on the victims as much as the killers, because the victims are just sort of the sensationalized objects when we focus on the murderer themselves. And I find all of that actually quite, in its own way, abhorrent.
Mm-hmm.
And you point that out in your own way in the book, where it's like, yeah, but if I then focus on making the victims this or that, so I quote unquote focus on them in this book about the murderer, mm-hmm. I'm still doing the same thing. I'm actually just kind of masking it. I'm just kind of covering up what I'm doing here. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there, it does more of a disservice to them in a way, to pretend, when, you know, instead something else. And so I'm just saying all that just to point out, that is another way of creating a narrative, an easily sort of reached for way of doing it. Well, if I humanize the victims and then show how monstrous this person is, then we can see a set of reasons here. There's innocence and there's guilt. Mm-hmm. There's purity and there's evil. There's, you know, those pat descriptions of victims of, you know, she loved dogs. She, yeah. You know, he enjoyed water slides as a child, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then this guy dressed as a clown killed them both, or what. I'm just coming up with some prurient, you know, example of it. So I think I was so glad that you resisted that, because you're like, I'm not going to do that either, because that's also just one way that people have done this for a really long time, and I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. I mean, it was really difficult to negotiate that sort of moral aspect of the book. And I still think, you know, of course the book is full of, you know, self-questioning and sort of moral triangulations and, you know, what right do I have to tell the story and to do it in the way that I'm doing it, and what's my position and so on. It's full of that stuff. So I hope it is a book that is, you know, inflected with a kind of a moral seriousness about what I'm undertaking. But I also think fundamentally, you know, if I was really concerned about what was the right thing to do, from the point of view of the victims' families who are still alive and still, for whom this is still very much an open wound, I think the correct thing to do would have been not to write it, not to exacerbate, not to sort of reopen that wound. But that said, I'm a writer, and I'm not going to do that. I think I'm not that moral. You know, there are other things driving me. But I had to try and do it in a way that was like, you know, I hope that my sort of, in a way, I feel like I wanted my aesthetic sensitivities and my moral sensibilities to be kind of operating on the same frequency when I was writing this book. So if something felt corny to me, then I also felt that it was probably morally off as well. And like, it's not to say that it would be corny to write this very full description of who Bridie Gargan was and who Donald Dunn was. I didn't, you know, in a way, I didn't have access to that much information. All I had was the sort of details that emerged in the reporting at the time in 1982 and 1983. So in some ways there was you know, a question of kind of expedience. Like the victims' families didn't want to talk to me, and that felt like it was frustrating in a way, but it was also like, yeah, why would they want to talk to me?
Totally, yeah.
You know, why would they hand over this material for narrative to someone like me? I wouldn't do that. And I get into this in the book, of course, like if I had been killed in a completely senseless and meaningless way by this complete stranger for reasons that even he didn't fully understand, and in any case had nothing to do with me or my life, would I want the material of my life to then be turned into narrative? And so there's a sense in which, you know, from a kind of a reading satisfaction point of view, and also maybe from a certain kind of moral point of view, to give a full sense of who the victims were increases the sense of the loss of those people, you know? But I just couldn't do it. It just felt like I didn't have a right to do it, you know, because as I say in the book, the manner of their deaths was not the meaning of their lives, you know? And I kind of just wanted to, it just felt somehow wrong to me to go into the kind of, the details of their lives. It felt like it would have been a kind of violation. It's not that I don't say anything about the victims. I do, but I don't turn them into narrative.
Yeah. I mean, it's so difficult because
I'm always kind of wary of like of my choices seeming like implicitly or explicitly like a kind of condemnation of writers who make other choices or, you know, other kinds of true crime, quote unquote, narrative or whatever. Like, I don't think I'm doing that. And I'm not even sure that what I did was right. I just know that it felt kind of right to me. Like, I'm just sort of feeling my way around in the dark morally.
Yeah.
And I can totally imagine another version of the book written by another kind of writer, which did that really well. But it just felt like I couldn't do it and feel like I was being true to what I was trying to do.
I mean, I understand that. I sort of frame that as like, you know, I have a responsibility to the morality of my own imagination, you know, like to the extent that I cultivate myself as a person who has compassion for others, then my imagination will start to take on its own moral contours, which I have to trust, you know. If I'm a shit person, I'm probably going to be much worse at that, you know? So it can't really take place in like those decisions can't really necessarily take place by the time you've started writing the book. Yeah. It's like those have had to have taken place within you as a person.
Right.
And then you write the book.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So I get it. But I also think it's difficult because if we're saying, I agree with you that like, this is one way of being a person is you are a murderer. Not, it's just like any other way, but it is one way that people are human as they make these choices or follow these compulsions or however you want to express it. But then also we have to accept that one way to die as a person is to be murdered. And this is very difficult. It's like, any narrative you read, I don't think anybody's really tried to construct this kind of book. Any narrative you read where it's about someone's life. So we read a love story or we read a story about someone, you know, becoming a pilot or winning a race or something like that. They usually end before the person dies, right? So we're not, if I read a book about someone's life, it's not, you know, or some important thing that makes them real to me. Very often, those narratives, those novels, whatever, memoirs certainly, will end before that person's death. But, you know, like if they died of cancer or in a tornado or were killed by somebody, like that would just be where the narrative ended. It's so confusing to think about even how to include being murdered as the way you die into a narrative of somebody's life.
Yeah.
I think I'm not articulating this very well.
No, I do. I do understand what you mean. Right. So, like, I think if this is part of, you know, when I talk about, like, feeling my way around in the dark, morally, there was this sense that, like, the end of a narrative, especially if you are murdered, sort of gives it, you know, there's like a sense of an ending, you know, it gives the rest of the story is given meaning and direction and purpose by the manner of its ending in some way. So yeah, like that's, I guess, part of what I'm getting at in the book is that I didn't want to give the lives of Bridie Gargan and Donald Dunn meaning, like to fix them in this book through what happened to them. Because my book, for better or worse, is about Malcolm MacArthur, right? And they could only ever be in the version of the story that I wanted to tell, either morally or immorally or amorally. The version of the story that I wanted to tell was about him. So their stories would be subordinate to his within this larger narrative, you know? And that felt already morally questionable to me, whether I include them or not.
Right.
And it's not that I don't include them, of course. I don't want to give that impression that I just don't mention the victims. Of course I do. And I, you know, try to reckon with the weight of the loss of their lives and try to make him feel it, you know? But when it came to narrative, yeah, something was staying my hand.
Yeah, because it's this weird thing of I'm going to valorize you because you were murdered is just in its own way as bad as I'm going to, like, whatever other choices you could make. I think there's this story by Joyce Carol Oates called The Girl with a Blackened Eye. It's a horrific story. It's a short story, obviously, but it's about a girl who's captured by a serial killer and he rapes her and he beats her. At the end, she says, it's first person. She starts talking to the reader and she says, I don't tell anybody about this. I'm only telling you because I know you won't tell anyone. And she says, it's so strange. I don't think my life, I'm married now, I have kids. I don't think my life would be any different. And nobody knows that this happened to me.
Yeah.
And I just think about the fullness of life that someone can have with these events that sometimes will end someone's life and sometimes won't. You're right, I think, who am I to say, but it seems to me that you're right to not create that as the defining anchor of the person's life, the way that they died or this thing that happened to them. If I think about the truly horrific thing, there are people in my family that have been murdered. If I think about the truly horrific things that have happened to me or their murders or whatever, I never think of it as the only thing that's happened, you know? And so you don't really have a choice but to make it that if you include too much of a story in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I almost think that you can't win, you know? Like, no matter what you do, it's wrong. Like, I just chose the wrong way to do it that I was most at ease with. And I'm not even that at ease with it. But, like, yeah, it was the way that felt like the wrong way to do it that felt most true to me, you know? That sounds very Beckettian in a way, but that's, yeah.
So I was thinking about this. We were talking about MacArthur, you know, the inability to sort of hold all the pieces of MacArthur's life and this thing together and have it all make sense. But I was also thinking about his inability to bring it into focus. And, you know, I think the closest you do come to psychiatry or psychoanalysis or whatever is when you sort of pick out the kinds of words he's using to mm-hmm. describe. And there's always a little bit of a distance there. Mm.
Yeah, like speaking about it in the third person and using the language of science to, yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah. And so I was thinking, like, you know, we all, and this is something that comes up, I think it'll come up for every reader of this book, but we all have our own kind of, like, disjunctions mm-hmm. with ourselves. These places that we are not in touch with who we are or what we've done. And, you know, so I wanted to talk about that a little bit, because when we're saying to be a person means that you could be a murderer, you know, it seems like his sort of disjunct aspect is murder, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas that someone else's might be something much smaller, but we all seem to have this disjunction, this way in which we are out of touch with ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, you know, for MacArthur, he would say, and has almost word for word said, I mean, I am actually putting words in his mouth, but how I would sort of, how I would translate a lot of the complexity and sort of lengthiness of what we talked about on the subject, I would sort of encapsulate it with MacArthur saying, yes, I committed murders, but that doesn't mean I'm a murderer. Mm. And part of that is it's so contradictory in ways that go beyond just the sort of logical contradiction of that. You know, I think he would want to believe, and you may well believe this as well, that we're all capable of doing something like what he did, you know? I don't know that that's true in the way that he wants it to be true, which is that, yeah, I can conceive that I might be possible of killing, you know, I might be capable of killing someone, you know, in the wrong set of circumstances. I might kill in self-defense or, you know, something like that. What he did was quite different, you know, it was something quite cold-blooded. It was chaotic, but it was cold-blooded and entirely unnecessary what he did. So that's why murder is a special sort of circumscribed, you know, sin or crime in our culture and in pretty much every culture. But so yeah, I think he wants to cordon off this fairly definitive aspect of what his life has been from the rest of his life. And that's why the book is called A Threat of Violence. You know, this, he says to me at one point, you can't say, because I'm trying to sort of explain what he did through, you know, certain aspects of his childhood, a neglectful mother, violent father, all those sorts of things. And he's saying that that's actually not the case. Mm. You can't say that there's a threat of violence that goes back to my childhood that can explain what I did. He wasn't happy about the title for that reason.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, we had, like, when you mentioned psychoanalysis, you know, just like I don't use the language of psychiatry, I definitely don't use the language of psychoanalysis in the book, but I can't get away from psychoanalysis. You know, it's like my PhD on Banville was very much a psychoanalytic engagement with his work. And to the extent that I have sort of guiding principles or sort of basic beliefs about humanity, it's that, it's the Freudian sense that we're not fully conscious of the things that motivate us and the things that drive us. Our fears and anxieties are often kind of, you know, largely unknown to us. And that's a big aspect of how I'm interpreting MacArthur. And, you know, I didn't really reveal my hand to him at any point, not deliberately, it just didn't really come up at any point while we were talking for the, you know, the conversations that made it into the book. Mm-hmm. But in that conversation where, so the book was announced publicly here in Ireland in November, and the title was, you know, part of an announcement, and then it was in the Irish Times, and, you know, I had a conversation with MacArthur on the phone where he was like very uncomfortable with the title because it was sort of a direct contradiction of something that he says in the book. You know, he says, you can't say that there's a threat of violence, and then I go and call the actual book A Threat of Violence. And he said that the title is misleading, and I said, well, no, it's not misleading. It's suggestive, and it's, you know, it's ironic, and when people read the book, they will understand that it at least in part, you know, alludes to a conflict going on between us about what is and is not the case and what can and can't be said and so on. But that conversation led to me saying, you know, I'm basically a Freudian. You know, I think we don't really understand our motivations, and I think we don't really know what we're doing, you know? And he was, I guess, the first time where he really kind of, I could see this like dawning horror, this sort of realization. And he said, like, well, if I'd known that, I'm not sure I would have, because he's very much not a Freudian, you know, in a way that is not, you know, not entirely resistant to analysis. I think he's very resistant to the idea of Freud's work and the idea that, you know, we don't know what we're doing, because he is absolutely insistent on the idea that he does understand himself, that he does, that he's entirely self-aware and entirely self-conscious. And of course,
But I mean, how strange, because there's a moment when he's being interrogated where he has this almost personality seizure where his eyes roll back in his head and he says, I'm regressing, I'm regressing. Mm. I mean, what could sound more the Freudian, you know, to be taken over for a moment, to be lost, and to say that that loss had something to do with regression. But I think that was the one time in the entire book where I thought, oh, maybe some shit did happen when he was a kid. Mm. And this is where I was thinking about Jeffrey Dahmer. You know, Jeffrey Dahmer apparently used to do this thing where his friends asked him to, like, he did like a fake seizure in high school. Oh. This is in the graphic novel, My Friend Dahmer. And then there's a...
It's a TV show as well.
A movie, I think, based on it, yeah. But the graphic novel is great. And he apparently, like, would do this...
The novel was by... the graphic novel was by someone who actually knew him, right?
Yeah, wow, okay. Who went to high school with him. Yeah. And apparently he would, like, perform these, like, seizures, like, as a joke at first.
A joke?
Like, he was... to impress his friends, to make them laugh. But then he almost couldn't stop doing them. Hmm. He would do them too much, and his friends would be like, come on, that's man. Weird. Like, don't do it anymore. At first they were egging him on, and then it was as if... And I saw this kind of in this, and I see this with a lot of people that I've read about that kill people. Because obviously I've done some reading on the subject
myself. I imagine you've read a lot more about this stuff than I have. Yeah.
But there's like a tear in who they are. When I'm talking about that disjunction, it's like it's in everybody, but maybe it's opened up a little too wide, and then something gets in them. From a spiritual standpoint, I would have my own sort of view of this. We don't need to go down that. Mm. But just say something gets in, or whether it's some aspect of their unconscious fills up the void in a bad way, or if you say that there's a spiritual crisis in them, or whatever you want to say, and then they can't... They live out of that. Whereas I think a lot of us, hopefully... would see that we have that disjunction and try to either accept it in the case of psychoanalysis, mend it in the case of therapy, fill it with a spiritual life in the case of, you know, spiritual development. Mm-hmm. It's actually just torn so wide and filled with something that is even more unknowable than the unconscious for people that kill.
Yeah. I mean, that's really interesting. I didn't know that about Jeffrey Dahmer. I don't know much about Jeffrey Dahmer. But what you talk about, the sort of like the disjunction between who we are and who we think we are, and the thing about joking, you know, the joking Caesar. I mean, that's a weird unresolved kind of theme of my book, is MacArthur's understanding of what jokes are and what can be said to be a joke, you know? Like, many times during our, you know, relationship, he would tell me something. And a lot of it didn't make it into the book, you know, because it's, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's off the record or whatever. But he would sometimes tell me something very, very revealing. And then he would call me, you know, a few days later or whatever, and say, oh, that wasn't true what I told you. It was a joke. And I would say, well, what do you mean a joke? What was the joke? And he was just, oh, you know, just a...
Well, that's in the book where he holds the gun to his friend.
I mean, the whole Harry Beeling fiasco, that whole incident is dismissed as
very briefly go over that, yeah.
Yeah, well, there's a whole dimension of the story where, like, after he murdered Donald Dunn and Bridie Gargan, he still hadn't actually managed to pull off a robbery, which was the whole pretext for the whole reason for these murders. And he arrived in the house of an acquaintance of his, this guy called Harry Beeling, an American former diplomat who was living in Dublin, arrived in his like really nice house on Killiney Hill, right beside where Enya lives, and pulled a gun on him and, you know, demanded money. And MacArthur, the following day, when it hadn't been pulled off, Beeling, you know, escaped, basically ran off down the road. MacArthur kind of realized, shit, I could be in trouble here. He's probably going to go to the cops. And he called him and said, you know, that was a joke, right? You know, I was making it was like a callback to some story you told me about you know, being mugged in New York that you'd forgotten about. And it was, again, this thing of misrecognition. You know, he didn't recognize MacArthur, and that's actually true. MacArthur thought he did recognize him, that he would get this joke. You know, it's all so Byzantine and like absurd. But yeah, there are many moments in the book where he tries to kind of, you know, a lot of it is about control. He's trying to sort of edit the record of reality by saying, actually, no, that's a joke, or that was kind of misunderstood, or whatever.
So maybe I understand that this is at once a completely unfair question and then a totally fair one, which is just to ask you, you know, what are we supposed to do with murderers? I mean, you know, your answer, not in words, but in action, is go talk to them. Mm. But I do think that that's the right answer in a way. I mean, it's also why I had, you know, Gwen Adsad, who we mentioned before, the author of Devil You Know, on the show, and I talked with her about it, is that there's a lot there. And sometimes I think, you know, John Ronson wrote this book, The Psychopath Test, and for me, that book really helped me understand, like, part of what we do with murderers is actually learn how to learn how to be there for each other, learn how to take care of each other and love each other. And that is because we're tested so thoroughly and deeply by them. And I don't just mean them. I mean, we, you know, writing about someone who's killed people with a sense of, I'm going to sit and be patient, certainly means, hopefully, at your best, that certainly should be applied to and offered to everyone, especially those who don't kill, in any circumstance.
Yeah. No, I think that's really good. I think that's, you know, kind of wonderful to hear in a way, because, like, you can tell talking to me, and we've talked about this book, you know, for much longer, you know, since I've been writing it, you can tell that there's a moral ambivalence that goes pretty deep in me about what I was doing and what I have done in writing about it. And you know, the book has only been out here for a week, and it's only just come out in the US today, but in some of the responses that I've got to it so far, like, there's a totally different tenor to the reaction to this book than anything I've done before. Most of which is good, but some of which is like some reflection of the ambivalence that I have had all along myself. And some of it is like overly simplistic. And, you know, I've had people say, you know, do you think you're glamorizing a murderer by writing about him in this way? And, like, you know, my answer to that is no, it's the opposite. You know, what glamorizes someone like MacArthur is not talking to him, is turning him into a fairy tale villain, you know, is only having the sort of, you know, photographic image of the suave, bow-tied, sophisticated killer, and these kind of endlessly rehearsed cliches about this, you know, moneyed aristocrat and blah, blah, blah. Like, that's what glamorizes him. And the silence around that is what glamorizes him. By going and talking to him and trying to get into the, like, murk and difficulty and contradiction of his humanity, that's, I think, I don't know if it's useful, but it's the only true way of thinking seriously about something like this.
I mean, we're not talking about someone who hasn't been accountable for the held accountable for the horrible things they've done, right? So I'm not, I mean,
the maybe, law has I mean, actually, in a weird way, you know, even though he's served 30 years in prison, he was never tried for the murder of Donald Trump.
Right.
So that's like, I think that's an almost like an equivalent violence, an institutional violence.
I agree, and that I mean, but that seems like an that's an extra violence exacted by the structures. I'm just saying, we're not talking about someone who hasn't, at least in some sense, maybe people don't think accountable enough, but been held accountable for what he did by society in a way. So it's not someone like who might have done something terrible, who's just getting off, you know, scot-free, and you're just kind of like, it's not that. You're approaching someone who is known as a murderer, who has been punished, so the question of accountability doesn't really come into play, to my mind, in the way that it might for other people, as to how do I approach, how do I talk to this person.
But there's like two senses of the word accountability, right? Yeah. There's accountability in the legal sense, and then there's like accounting for what you did.
Right.
You know, the narrative sense of like, can you account for this?
Yes.
And that's what I'm trying to do.
Yes.
And like, in a way, I think it seems totally contradictory, but in a way, I feel like he hasn't really, in some sense, justice hasn't been served because it can't be served. But I want,
right.
I want, and this is obviously problematized in lots of different ways throughout the course of the book, but one of the things I want from him is a sense that he feels the weight of his crimes. Mm. You know, I want him to be, as I say in the book, I want him to be crushed under the weight of his iniquity. Mm-hmm. You know, I want him to be Raskolnikov. I'm like, why do I want that?
Right. That's the question for me as I read, yeah, is that's why the most
disturbing thing about him
reaching for this so much? What's he hoping for in the, what kind of weird absolution are you hoping for in someone recognizing that they cannot be absolved? You know, I mean, it's so, it's obviously, and I think.
It's funny because, like, you know, I'm not a Christian. Uh-huh. You know? And, you know, the two people in this room.
That you know of.
Yeah, that I know. Well, maybe I am, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
You know, maybe I'm more of a Christian than you are. I just haven't really worked through it, you know?
I mean, so why I brought up the accountability thing, just to sort of backtrack, is like, when there's this moment early on, your first real encounter with him, where you're talking with him, where someone starts taking photographs of you, and he talking. Right. And or accusing. Right. And you're like, well, shit, now people are going to think whatever, I'm entangled with him. Now, of course, he already was entangled with your imagination, but this is different. And so you've taken on the responsibility. So your accountability is also there, where it's like, now this person is a part of my life forever. Mm-hmm. I've chosen to sit with them. And I've chosen to listen. And that also requires a sort of endurance and a kind of accountability that I'm going to struggle with. And you'll probably struggle with it for many years to come as well. And I think that that's right. I think that it's something that I'm not saying we all need to go sit with people who have killed others, although many of us do, because we have members of our family who are in the military, or we have members of our family who sign pieces of paper that have policy that murder people or whatever, but that we wrestle really with the depth of our entanglement with those who kill and think about how we treat them, who we excuse and why, and who we condemn forever and why, and who we are in relationship to that. I have a photo of you somewhere. I'll try and find it, talking to him on the phone.
Oh, right.
Do you know about this?
Well, just as you were saying that, I remembered that conversation. It was like the first time we met, I think, right? In person.
No. It was the first time we met in person?
I think so. Yeah, I'd done your podcast, but I don't think we'd met
in person. I don't know, but we were hanging out in the park and you got a phone call and you're like, oh, it's Malcolm McCarthy. Actually, I saw it on your phone.
Yeah.
And then you walk away and I took a picture of you and you're kind of kneeling as if in grief in the park, talking to him, stressed out about whatever was going on. I mean, the whole process, and even now, of course, now as the book comes out, you're enduring the weight of what it means to actually consider these questions. And I think that that is what is for us in this, if there's anything for us, is what we have to do.
It just struck me that conversation took place in a churchyard, right?
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. And I remember
St. Kevin's.
Yeah, right. And I remember you mentioning that day that you making that sort of not equivalence but like connection between, you know, people you knew growing up in the US who like served quote unquote in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on, and you said, you know, these people have killed, why is their killing somehow more like or less problematized socially than what this guy did? I don't know if I fully like agreed with that point, but it stuck with me and it made me, you know, it's still there, you know?
Yeah. And in fact, many of the people who are killed by them, their entire families are killed.
Yeah.
There's no one even left to grieve to tell the story.
Yeah.
And those people are either heroes or forgiven.
Yeah.
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 To end, I'm going to have you read an excerpt from the book. It's a little bit of a long excerpt, but I think it gets to the heart of everything we're talking about. And so before I do that, I just want to thank you for being on the show. And everybody go by A Thread of Violence. I almost want to say it's a beautiful book, but I don't know if that's the right word. I don't hesitate to use that word. I'm not like someone that shies away from using a word like that. It's a book that, I will say this. This is a word that appears on the blurbs of books all over the world, but I don't really use it. I mean it. It's necessary that this book happened. Passive. It's necessary that this book happened, but and I'm so glad and happy to be friends with the person that wrote this necessary book. So thank you, Mark.
Thank you. That's kind of wonderful.
And all right. Thanks everybody for listening. Here's Mark reading from A Thread of Violence.
As the months passed, MacArthur began to feel more comfortable in my presence, and I came to see that, in a wary sort of fashion, he liked me. He was surprisingly earnest about this, saying that he held me in very high regard, and that he could see that I had a first-rate intelligence, and even that I was a very decent fellow. He saw me as a worthy interlocutor. It sometimes seemed to me, in fact, that I was precisely the kind of person, a person who made a living, for better or worse, through thinking and writing, he himself, as a younger man, might have wanted to become had he not become a murderer. One day he was making a passing reference to his time in prison, when he paused and asked me not to mention this particular story in my book. He was wary, he said, of doing anything to irritate or embarrass the prison authorities. But if I wanted to hear more about his years behind bars, he said, he would be happy to speak to me about it on what he called a friendly basis, by which I understood him to mean off the record. We may even become friends, he said then, with a slightly nervous laugh, if you would consider the possibility. Yes, I said, with a nervous laugh of my own. It was an insufficient response, I realized, but it was as much as I could manage. I had certainly considered the possibility that a measure of ease, and even a kind of intimacy, might eventually enter into our exchanges. I knew that he was lonely, and that he was flattered and intrigued by my interest in him. Until that point, I couldn't quite tell whether what appealed to him about me was the prospect of conversation alone, or of my turning those conversations into a piece of writing about him. He had, as I had suspected, been approached by writers in the past, but these tended to be crime writers and tabloid journalists, people whose interest in him he saw as puerile and exploitative. Some of these journalists had, he said, offered him extraordinarily large sums of money to speak to them, six-figure sums. He had not, he told me, been tempted even for a moment. For one thing, he would have been sent directly back to prison for profiting from his crimes, and for another, he no longer needed any money, ironically enough, because the state provided for his needs. In any case, I was aware of the risk of his coming to think of me as a friend, and this possibility was unnerving to me for two reasons. The first was simple enough. I had no wish to be friends with a man who had murdered people, no matter how long ago this had happened, and no matter what stance he took toward it now. The second was slightly more complicated. I felt uneasy about the degree to which I was already benefiting from MacArthur's openness, and I had no desire to manipulate him by seeming to be his friend. I had reminded him a number of times in our first few meetings that, although I would respect his wishes that I not write about certain things, and that the last thing I wanted was for him to wind up back in prison as a result of my book, I could not offer him any reassurance that he would like what I ended up writing. Chances were, I said, that he would feel wrong-footed or even betrayed by what I wrote, because what I wrote would, after all, be my view of him, and by no means an exoneration or apologia. He seemed entirely at peace with this prospect. He had seen and done worse things in his time, I supposed, than an unfavourable portrayal in a work of literary non-fiction. He could hardly have been hoping for a favourable portrait, I felt, given that he was, in the final analysis, a murderer. In any case, he continued to talk. In our early conversations, I had surprised myself by the uncharacteristically professional approach I was taking. I had sat at his little frosted glass table, taking note in my notebook of everything he said, interjecting at certain points with judicious questions, seeking clarification of timelines and so on. At first, it had seemed to me that I was doing this because I wanted to access the truth, or at least his version of it, his narrative. But I realized quickly enough that this rigidly professional approach, the notebook and pen, The voice recorder, the strangely formal line of questioning, was in fact an elaborate defense against the possibility that he might warm to me as a human being. It took a little while longer to realize that it was also, and perhaps more pressingly, a defense against the possibility that I might warm to him. As the weeks and months progressed, we spoke fairly regularly on the phone. Often I would call him, but just as often it would be he who called me. Hardly anyone else, in fact, ever called me out of the blue. He tended to call in the evenings, so that if I felt my phone buzz with an incoming call in my pocket any time after dinner, I could always be reasonably certain it was either my father or Malcolm MacArthur. He would always have some reason for calling, often to revise or to strike from the record entirely some remark he had made the last time we spoke. But I sometimes suspected that these were just pretexts for getting a monologue going. As the weeks and months progressed, we spoke fairly regularly on the phone. Often I would call him, but just as often it would be he who called me. Hardly anyone else, in fact, ever called me out of the blue. He tended to call in the evenings, so that if I felt my phone buzz with an incoming call in my pocket any time after dinner, I could always be reasonably certain it was either my father or Malcolm MacArthur. He would always have some reason for calling, often to revise or to strike from the record entirely some remark he had made the last time we spoke. But I sometimes suspected that these were just pretexts for getting a monologue going, for talking about a film he had seen years ago, or for delving into some matter of philosophical or scientific interest. One evening, in the long days between Christmas and New Year's, he called me to tell me about an article he'd read in the paper. He thought I'd be interested to hear, he said, that a German literary scholar claimed to have discovered the exact date on which Joyce had set Finnegan's Wake. I was interested to hear this, I said, although mostly I was interested in the fact of his telling me about it. Not long after that, he called one evening to say that he'd been discussing me with his probation officer. He wanted to prepare her, he said, for the fact that my book would be coming, and that he'd been talking to me for it. She's a very reasonable person, he said. Swedish, luckily, not Irish. Very practical people, the Swedes. He was always talking about this probation officer. He had great admiration for her, and his admiration was clearly bound up with her being from Sweden, a nation he associated with rationality and fair-mindedness. I told her, he said, that it was very important that this whole thing was dealt with by a person such as yourself, a serious person, a person with very high intellectual standards. I said I was glad to be thought of in this way, as a person with high intellectual standards, although in truth I wasn't sure what it meant. And then he said, "You know, you've become a very important person in my life." "And vice versa," I said, "as I'm sure you're aware." He raised once again, tentatively and almost shyly, the prospect of our association evolving into a friendship. I said, by way of evasion, that he should defer any decision on that until my book came out. One evening, I had just put my three-year-old daughter in her pajamas and brushed her teeth, and we were lounging on her bed for a while before I read her story. I had caved to her persistent demands and given her my phone to look at, and I was reading a book. She liked to look through the photos and videos on my phone, probably because most of them were of her. She was swiping with practiced ease, gazing fondly at images of her slightly younger self, when I heard the buzz of an incoming call. I glanced over at the phone in her hands, and I saw the word MacArthur on its screen, and I felt a wave of dread pass through me. I put out my hand for the phone, saying that I would fix it for her. I let it ring out, and at length his name disappeared from the display. The photo my daughter had been looking at rematerialized, a photo of her and her little dog hugging on the couch. I put the phone on silent and pocketed it, telling her it was time to read her story. All the rest of that evening, I couldn't get it out of my head. His name on the screen, the unsettling thrum of the phone in her little hands.